You ready to go, Bobby?
All right.
According to recent articles in the Wall Street Journal, the new leader of Pakistan, General Musharraf, is going forward with his cleanup campaign. He has charged the ousted premier, along with eight others, with capital crimes. And in the meantime, India and Pakistan are fighting again in Kashmir. We're going to talk a little bit about what's going on, get an update on Pakistan's situation, as we are joined now by Imran Anwar, founder of Imran Net Services in New York, pioneer of internet email in Pakistan, and of course a well-known media expert on India, Pakistan, and Southeast Asia. Hi, Imran.
Hi, George.
Fill us in, bring us up to date. What is happening? First of all, let's concentrate internally. Where are they in moving forward with what we would all hope would be ultimately a democratic government in Pakistan?
Well, George, the problem is that I don't see any clear roadmap still being shown or actually still being recognized by the government itself. When I see a temporary or interim government, whether legal or illegal or one taken over by force, when I see cabinets being announced and lots of ministers being announced, that to me is the first step towards an entrenched government which can take 11 years to get rid of. And so that is what I am seeing, but no roadmap as far as a return to real democracy.
The move that is going on now, is this is this some kind of vengeance, or is this warranted? They are pushing for capital punishment, actually. They're being charged with capital crimes, pushing for the death penalty, although I understand the international community is asking not that they not do that. In terms of charges levied against the former prime minister and some of his associates?
Quite frankly, George, I think that would be a despicable act, even if the charges are true that they endangered the lives of passengers or wanted the plane to land in India.
They're calling that kidnapping. I mean, there's technicality there. They're saying that is tantamount to kidnapping, and of course, also there are charges of treason being levied.
I think the first thing we should keep in mind is that if treason in its real definition is to be used, then the general and the ex-premier will probably hang on the same day together, because overthrowing the government with abrogation or dissolution of assemblies and hurting the constitution in any way is treason punishable by death in Pakistan. However, kidnapping is a technicality, and I'm not saying that that's not how it can be looked at. I'm sure it can be looked at that way. What I'm hoping is that they are using it as a ploy or a bargaining chip to basically get some financial returns of looted wealth from Nawaz Sharif, the ex-prime minister, and his family, or also basically to make sure that any potential detractors or opposers of the military regime are put on notice that they mean business. But then how would they get the money out of Benazir Bhutto and her clan? I don't know what death penalty can be imposed on her as a threat.
Now, so am I picking up from you that when we talked about this initially, and quite frankly, as I have listened to discussions on it from analysts and from others that I've talked to, it seems there's a degree of sympathy, or has been at least up to now, with General Musharraf and his motives for the coup, and also a great deal of suspicion and cynicism about what kind of a democracy was really in effect in Pakistan in any case, and so on. But am I picking up from you now that some of your cynicism is moving toward, turning now toward the general?
Yes, George, I have been on record as being cynical about any military government taking over, having seen the effects of what the late dictator Zia did to the country. Mm-hmm. You and I have talked about this, that even though what the general committed was an act of treason, but the fact that it has popular support means one can look the other way and say if the end result is going to be some sort of real democracy and some sort of justice being done in the case of the wealth of the nation that has been plundered, so be it, and it's a good thing. So the cynicism was that it was still all these actions took place when the general's own job / life were endangered. And if it had not happened, he might have been there for another few years. So that's the cynic in me talking about that.
The reason I ask is that you pick up, as you talk to people about this and as you read the reports and the debates, that yes, a coup is a heinous thing, particularly levied at a democratically elected government, but the nature of the democratic government in Pakistan was such that it was, as I said, highly in question, drew a lot of cynicism from the international community. It's real questionable, from what I understand, as to whether or not it really amounts to democracy, given the power that a few wealthy families have and how they control big chunks of Pakistan. And anyone, you know, living inside of their, in essence, fiefdoms, more or less vote the way they are supposed to vote. That at least is the impression you pick up. And then he was systematically undermining and dismantling the democratic structure of Pakistan, if you can believe what you read, so that you are left with a sense of obviously concern about a coup, but a sense of sympathy, much like you might feel about a mutiny, you know. And we've seen, you know, mutiny on the Bounty. Obviously, mutiny is a heinous thing, but in that one case, you were left with a certain sympathy for the mutineers. I mean, that's kind of what the international community seems to be left with.
Absolutely, George, we are in agreement on that. My concern is that this undermining of democratic institutions began with General Zia, who was very much the military dictator, and who led to almost a total disruption, not just of the democratic process, but also led to a destruction of institutions, led to an increase in crime, led to ethnic violence and religious abuse,
right.
Basically. So my concern here is, George, that I am hoping, and I am still, hoping that the general will live up to the promise that he will help bring real democracy, however he defines it, or however the world would like to see it. What I am concerned about is that when I am looking at very well thought out or very well put together cabinets, a cabinet is a show of your intention to govern for some period of time. Now, the second concern I have is, except for Shaukat Aziz of Citibank, who I am an admirer of and his professionalism that I respect, him running financial affairs, which are one of the reasons that the military says it came into power, I can see that happening. But the other cabinet positions are going to people whose names I have heard all the life that I have lived in Pakistan, and even when I have been living in America. These are names of people who have, in one form or another, been in cabinets before, so I don't know what else is new there. These are the same people, just a different group this time that's coming to the forefront. And what is stopping them from exploiting the fact that they will be the ones signing off on projects and getting money to get to move a file A from point A to point B? So that will still go on. That has not changed. The daily routine of life, the daily fact that there might be bribes involved or there's corruption in society has not gone away. The crime has not gone away. Carjackings are taking place. And we now see even political terrorism that took place just last night.
So the proof is in the pudding, and this gentleman, at least at the moment, from your assessment, looks a little more like the same old than he does the hope for Pakistan's future. But you're willing to what? Give him a little more time to make sure that he's going to do the right thing, or to be sure that he's not going to do the right thing?
George, I am praying that he will do the right thing, and I am wishing that he will do the right thing, and I am hoping that he will do the right thing. But the fact that we've been down this path before, and the signals that I am seeing, do not help me make my mind up either way. I do not see anything that is showing me how the so-called real democracy is going to come in. And the fact that the death penalty is basically being threatened against the ousted leader, or the ousted prime minister, I should say, smacks of basically vendettas and basically the same thing that was done by General Ziaul-Haq to Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto. The saying is that there is one grave and there are two men. One has to go into that grave. And if that's what we're doing, I'll talk to you in another 11 years.
Imran, we are going to take a quick break, if that's all right with you. Please stay with us, and you folks do the same. We'll be right back. We are back. We're talking with Imran Anwar, founder of Imran Net Services in New York, pioneer of internet email in Pakistan, and of course a well-known media expert on India, Pakistan, and Southeast Asia. We're talking about Pakistan. Imran, let me ask then, we've been talking pretty much about what the internal situation is, and it's still much in question and in doubt, but let me ask what is happening now between India and Pakistan. as violence has erupted again in Kashmir between the two countries?
Basically, George, that is going to remain the root cause of all problems between India and Pakistan. Kashmir is the root cause, and let's not make any mistake about that. And the fact that this is an issue that both countries feel very strongly about, and both countries are nuclear powers, does not bode well for either of those two parties or for the rest of the world. The fact that escalations continue speaks again towards the point that I have made on this show and other shows in the last several months, is that it is, if the world community is so worried about democracy in Pakistan, that is the least of our problems. Pakistanis are capable of handling themselves and living their lives even under the most ruthless dictators like we had under General Zia or this new one. That is not going to be the problem. What endangers the very existence of the people of Pakistan and people in that region and world peace and security and the health of the entire planet is the risk of the situation in Kashmir escalating into a conflict that can take on nuclear proportions. If that happens, we are in trouble, and I don't see anybody talking about that problem.
Well, it has, you see me talking about it, because I was talking to an analyst just recently, and of course talking to you, about the fact, and making the case, that the United Nations, and you tell us, because you know the history of it better, but the United Nations, in essence, ruled on this, and the ruling was that the people, and this is what, many years ago now, I don't know, 50 years ago, and the ruling was that the people of Kashmir should be allowed to decide their own fate. India has basically intervened in that. Now, India is not wrong on everything that goes wrong between India and Pakistan, certainly. But in this instance, they appear to be in the wrong camp.
India is refusing to let that right of self-determination being exercised by the Kashmiri people. In addition, India refuses any kind of international mediation. So Pakistan actually has not even cashed in as much as it can and should on the global front in terms of marketing its position by saying, we're willing to talk international mediation, we want the UN to be involved, and the UN has been much more active even in issues like East Timor, where even if that situation had not been resolved for another 5 years, even if unfortunate bloodshed had continued to occur, the ramifications and even the amount of blood that would have flowed and the risks to the whole planet were minuscule compared to what is likely to happen in Kashmir. And that is a problem I have with this whole situation.
But when the general came into power, he seemed to assure the international community that was much concerned about this issue, if for nothing else, for selfish reasons, because it involves two nuclear powers with very fractious relationships, over an issue that seems to be as difficult to solve, whatever the reasons, as, say, the Northern Ireland issue, he seemed to appease the international community by, in essence, saying that that was not going to be a problem, right? He had a lot of other problems that he had to solve, and that he was going to kind of maintain a tenuous peace there and let that lie for a while, let that lay for a while. And apparently that is not the case.
Well, George, even when he said that, the idea was to clarify to the world that the reason he was coming into power, I mean, you and I suspect the real reasons and the real motivation for overthrowing the Prime Minister, but let's say that his reason was to help solve the country's problems. He wanted the world to understand that he was not coming into power so that he could press the nuclear button, for example, and or start a war in Kashmir. That was not the disagreement that he had over with the Prime Minister that led him to arrange for the coup. What he was talking about was that he had come into power because of serious internal issues that the country faces, and that's what he was going to focus on. And he was
He did, you know, there was some questioning of him about this because some had said, look, Mr. Sharif had capitulated to the West on this issue, and we're concerned that maybe that is part of your motive. And he assured everyone it was not. And also, again, said that he was going to, in essence, let sleeping dogs lie.
Right. But, George, let's remember that he de-escalated the military tensions on the non-Kashmir borders between India and Pakistan. Mm-hmm. But in Kashmir, he actually did say that that is the root cause and that has to be solved. Now, what he did not threaten was that, well, if you don't solve it, I will do something about it in the next 2 weeks. But the root cause remains. And, again, let's remember one more thing, George, that in a country like Pakistan, a lot of the problems are economic, and obviously the economic problems lead to less education, which leads to a lower likelihood of democracy flourishing in a country. Now, the fact that a lot of our budget actually goes to defense and military spending, that comes from a lot of the fact that Pakistan and India are always at loggerheads about Kashmir. The interesting thing is that if these two countries were to solve the Kashmir problem, and if the United Nations plebiscite was arranged, either way, whatever the Kashmiri people decided, both countries would actually have an economic benefit, because there would be less need. They disagree on everything, but they're not constantly going to war over the Punjab or the Sindh borders that they have in common. It's Kashmir that always is the root cause, but obviously if a war starts, it takes up a lot more resources along the whole 1,000-mile border, for example.
Well, this sounds like an issue that India is fairly hardened on, whether whatever we think of the position. They have an emotional and historical attachment to Kashmir. And it seems as though the only thing Pakistan would be willing to agree on, finally, would be let the people vote, and we'll go with that, being fairly confident, since it's a mostly Muslim population, that they would win.
Right, and again, so the Pakistani government, regardless of who has been in power, has always been confident of the fact that the decision would be accepted. So there's always a risk you take, George. I mean, the people might say, you know, something, the Indians aren't that bad, and they've spent a lot of money developing, blah, blah, blah.
But that's the same problem we had in Northern Ireland, where they would say, let them vote on it, and we'll go whatever direction they're going to vote, knowing full well that the majority of the people in Northern Ireland were Protestant, and you'd wind up with the status quo. In this case, you would wind up with perhaps going to Pakistan, but that would, far from solving the problem, almost certainly just reverse the tension. In other words, now you would have a separatist movement in Kashmir that wants to go back to India, as if you went to Ireland, if Northern Ireland becomes part of Ireland, you'd have a separatist movement that wants to go back to being an individual country or being aligned with the UK.
Right, George. In that case, no country in the world. We could be any country in the world, and we can have 2 or 3% of the people wanting to have some country of their own. It could be, let's say, the people in Texas might say, or even the militias that we have in parts of America who might want to have their own little government, or it might, let's say, an ethnic minority in the U.S. happens to have a high concentration in, say, Washington, D.C. and decided, that is something that you can always
right.
bring
so,
up.
So you're saying that the population, the immensity of, the enormity of the population that wants to be part of Pakistan almost certainly clarifies this issue, where a small percentage, obviously, of malcontents will always show up anywhere.
Absolutely. And, yeah. And George, I'll add something else to that. It's almost like saying, let's let O.J. Simpson walk, because otherwise the African-American community might be upset. I mean, are we going to make decisions based upon what is just and what is right, or based upon what is going to potentially have keep the status quo and make sure nothing untoward happens? In the meantime, the simmering tensions are the actual problem that are not being solved.
And we're out of time, but real briefly, where do you see the current tensions? How dramatic are they, and where is this going? Where is it going? Where is it going to lead us?
Actually, India is taking a wait and see attitude. The Pakistanis are basically focused more on the internal issues, and as well as with the government trying to entrench itself and strengthen its position. The Pakistani people are waiting for that miracle when suddenly like $5 or $8 billion in looted wealth will suddenly show up in a cash balance, and everybody will be rich and live happily ever after the next day. And then we will have true democracy. Of course, that's not going to happen. And once that reality sinks in, that is when whoever becomes the opposition, or whoever finds that the government of the military rulers is now on the defensive, will use Kashmir and will again fan the flames, which will lead us back to the root cause of all problems in that region, which is Kashmir, which the United Nations had made decisions on that have to be implemented.
Imran, we are out of time, but thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Imran Anwar, founder of ImranNet Services in New York, pioneer of internet email in Pakistan, well-known media expert on India, Pakistan, and Southeast Asia.